This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In his new book, Satanic Purses, Tom Naylor reminds us that the so-called War on Terror not only has a military front abroad combined with the constriction of democratic rights at home, but it also has a parallel financial front, hence the subtitle of Naylor's book, Money, Myth, and Misinformation in the War on Terror. Somalia is the focus of one of Naylor's chapters in his book, the same Somalia whose people once again are being callously bombed. As Oxfam reported, in one bombing raid, the U.S. killed 70 nomadic herdsmen gathered around a nighttime fire tending their animals. Of course, the U.S. claimed to be aiming at three shadowy individuals alleged to be responsible for the destruction of the U.S. embassy in Kenya. Earlier this week, I spoke with Tom Naylor, professor of economics at McGill University in Montreal. We focused on Somalia, but to set the context, I began by asking him to outline the main theme of his book, Satanic Purses.
Well, first of all, I guess I got to give a little bit of background. I mean, I'm sort of a criminologist and a historian and so on. And, you know, when I was working actively in the criminology field, I kept coming across all these ridiculous stories about great mafia conspiracies and the grand godfather who was running all these rackets all over the world, using huge amounts of money from his rackets to try to undermine Judeo-Christian civilization, all of this kind of nonsense. It's Hollywood nonsense, which unfortunately the police and the security services in much of the West tend to absorb and believe and act upon. And then once the, 911 came along and all the fingers started pointing at Osama and they said, well, look, he's the guy responsible, et cetera, et cetera. And then the same model gets trotted out. You have a great godfather, an evil figure, running a transnational cartel, mixing crime and terror, threatening once again to undermine Judeo-Christian civilization. I said, you know, this all sounds very familiar. It's like, the template has just been recycled. What's the truth behind this? Because we know with the mafia legend and so on, it was grossly exaggerated. There was a little basis for truth, and then it's grossly exaggerated. Because, first of all, the pop images run amok, and people get trapped by these pop images in turn, a classic case of blowback. And second, all kinds of vested interest bandwagon on the pop image and start to stake their futures, political or financial, on that image. And so I thought, hey, is this happening with the Al-Qaeda image and Bin Laden as well? And sure enough, as I poked around, it turned out to be exactly the same thing. A small element of truth, which then gets distorted and exaggerated, basically to aid and abet ongoing agendas that different vested interest groups, political, business, and so on, happen to have.
One of the chapters of the book concentrates on the theme you've outlined, but in the context of Somalia. Could you tell us a little bit more, how does Somalia fit into this general mythology that you've identified?
Well, what I did in the book, among other things, is you could sort of think of the book as, I guess, two or three major themes. One of them is the myth of the money trail, that Osama's got these mega gazillions of dollars that he's using to finance terror all over the world. And I followed the leads, the so-called rackets that he runs, all the nonsense about Islamic charities, etc., about the underground banking system. It turned out that the underground banking system he's supposed to use to move his money from rackets all over the world, the most important supposed link was the Somalia-based so-called Hawala system. Now, basically that was a country that was running on charity from abroad, from the Somalia diaspora, sending their money home. There was no banking system operating in Somalia, so they sent it to these informal networks, and the American government declared this informal network, the same one that was sending several hundred million dollars a year and keeping Somalia alive, was a mechanism being used by USAMA to fund terror all over the world, including funding the World Trade Center attacks. So that's why they moved. One of the first things they did was to move to shut this thing down, cutting off the only source of foreign exchange into a country that was a total basket case. So that was one of the leads. The second thing that I was doing in the book was also following the sort of, we might call it, travels with USAMA, where he was supposed to have been and operated throughout the world. So, you know, I have a chapter on the Sudan and several on Afghanistan, and one on Somalia, because according to the Americans, according to one of the myths, he's been operating there for a long time, including being responsible, so they would tell you, for that embarrassing situation in 1993 when the American Special Forces got their arses kicked and had to retreat from Somalia in an undignified way. So the Pentagon was just itching for an excuse to go back in there and even some scores. And, of course, USAMA becomes a great pretext for doing so. So both of those things, which are the two central themes, I guess you could say, of the book, pointed towards Somalia. Now, Somalia isn't the main focus of the book. It's one of the incidental places that I visit en route. But it's suddenly become extremely relevant because of recent American operations.
In your chapter on Somalia, you outline a history that you regard as essential to a realistic understanding of the events in that country and the structures of that society. I know it's quite a lengthy piece, but what would you highlight for us, at least from the Cold War period through to post 9/11, that we should have in mind when we read news about that country?
I think when we go into and read news about countries, as soon as we see the name of a country, we start thinking about nation states in the orthodox kind of Western model. Well, that's an aberration in human history. It's quite recent, about two centuries old, and applies really to Western Europe and not to much more. Somalia was a country that it was never a political unit. It was always, even though it's an area with a remarkably high degree of ethnic homogeneity and religious homogeneity, about 95% Sunni Muslims. They all speak the same language, etc., but they're divided up into clans and sub-clans and things like that, and people's primary loyalty is to immediate family, then to sub-clan, clan, etc., and only vaguely to the concept of Somalia as a country. And as a result, the country was actually divided up. What's now Somalia was divided up by various powers: Italy, Britain, some pieces were quasi-independent, Italy, Britain, and who else? Okay, of course, Ethiopia took a slice, etc. So what happened after decolonization began in Africa, people tried to piece together these bits and odds and ends of Somalia and try and create a country. And this, of course, on top of the clan structure, which tends to coincide roughly with territory, but not completely. So the only way you could really create a sort of an apparently normal country was basically through a military dictatorship, and that's what you had. The rise of an American-backed military dictator who then later on played footsies with the Soviet Union, and then later on switched his allegiance again to play footsies with the Americans. And he managed through strong-arm means and through a lot of corruption as well as intimidation to transcend the clan-based power structure. But eventually it all fell apart. The end of the Cold War, he was no longer useful. The Americans pulled support. It degenerated into clan-based feuds that had their territorial base. And that remained in a state of anarchy for about 15 years until the Islamists managed to take control briefly, eliminate much as happened in Afghanistan, eliminate a large part of the feuding, establish the basis for some sort of social stability, and now the Americans say these Islamists must be agents of Al-Qaeda, and so they've been targeted to be knocked out. There's many of them have been killed in the American bombings or in the Ethiopian invasion.
You referred to the 93 American military defeat and retreat from Somalia. But the Americans had gone in, as you point out, under something called an Operation to Restore Hope, which then transformed into an operation to establish a stable government. You say they expended an outrageous sum of $2.4 billion on their military escapade. Does this also ring parallels with what's happening in Afghanistan?
Well, to some degree. In Afghanistan, though, there's a huge difference. Afghanistan is an anthropologist's nightmare. There's so many tribes and nationalities and sects and so on, whereas Somalia is remarkably homogeneous. Now, Afghanistan, in spite of this tremendous heterogeneity of the population, has never had anybody seriously consider secession or independence, whereas Somalia, ironically enough, with a religious and ethnically homogeneous population, is constantly threatened with that. So there is a big difference there. But the things they have in common is warlord rule, except in Afghanistan it frequently has a tribal kind of basis, or even an ethnic base, which it really doesn't have in, not in the same sense in Somalia. So you do have the warlords, regional warlords, asserting power. You do have a very weak central government that has to make deals, using a little bit of intimidation where it can, but usually using corruption, buying allegiance and so on. And you have American intervention in part for strategic reasons, in part for economic. I mean, oil and gas are a factor in both, plus the strategic location, Afghanistan, of course, bordering the ex-Soviet republics, and Somalia commanding a great deal of the coast of the Red Sea. Okay, so there are elements there, but I wouldn't push it too far. I think the thing in common is this American paranoia about militant Islam, and it's partly a paranoia and it's partly a pretext to advance their particular agenda in the Middle East and Central Asia.
That brings me to the current situation in Somalia, where the Ethiopian government, not for the first time, has been involved in seizing, interfering, let's put it, invading and presently occupying a lot of Somalia, where the Americans have resumed their war under the guise of fighting Islam. Is this simply a repeat of what was happening before, or are there new and significant dimensions to this phase?
Well, there's always been a jockeying for power between, you know, whoever is powerful in and around Somalia and whoever is running the show in Ethiopia. But initially, remember, it was the other way around. Ethiopia occupies the Ogaden Desert, which is part, you could say, of historical Somalia, but it's never existed as a country. But it's Somali-inhabited area. So, in fact, during the Cold War, the strongman ruling Somalia, who is at that point backed by the Soviet Union, invaded Ethiopia, invaded to seize the Ogaden Desert. And then, of course, the Soviet Union said, absolutely not, you're not allowed to do that, and it began backing Ethiopia. Then the Americans came in to back, that's exactly, in fact, what wooed Somalia away from the pro-Soviet to a pro-American position. The Americans gave him carte blanche to proceed with the war, but the strongman was defeated. But that was there was a legacy of hostility between them, but that's probably the most important recent event. That combined with the independence of Eritrea. Because once Eritrea, which used to be attached to Ethiopia, once it became independent, Ethiopia had no access to the sea. So the best way to get access to the sea is to control a piece of Somalia. So those two things, the residual anger over the Ogaden War and the desire to have some sort of hegemony over a piece of the coastland, that, together with American sponsorship, is what brought the Ethiopian invasion.
And the relation between the regional events and the preparation for a war against Iran, which the Americans are seemingly intent upon, is Somalia simply a diversionary war to...
I'm not sure. I keep going hot and cold on that. Is it just a diversion because the Americans are afraid to go after Iran? Or is it basically a staging point to a rehearsal, let's call it a dress rehearsal for the Iranian invasion? Or is it simply an attempt to say to the Iranians, look, we'll bomb the bejesus out of you if you don't do what we say? It's not entirely clear.
One last question.
Maybe all of those things that work in different people's minds, and they simply come together, and what would they say? Well, what we agree on is send some cruise missiles and some special forces into Somalia.
One last question, Tom. Canada has a history of some involvement in Somalia. Could you identify what role we've been playing?
I don't think it's got much of an involvement in terms of strategic. No, I mean, there's the usual kind of humanitarian do-gooderism stuff, but most of which turns out to be, you know, well-intended but totally counterproductive, by the way. But I don't think it's heavily involved in that. I mean, I think that it's got more than enough to worry about with its blundering its way into Afghanistan. Why does it need another disaster zone like Somalia? The armed forces in Canada are, of course, hopelessly stretched, completely incompetent to do the job they've been assigned in Afghanistan. And while the generals keep agitating for more and bigger equipment, I'm not sure they're going to get what they want. So I don't see a major Canadian role other than as a yes man for the United States and running errands at the UN for the United States.
Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
My great pleasure.
That was Tom Naylor, professor of economics at McGill University. The interview was recorded this Tuesday. Tom Naylor's most recent book is Satanic Purses, Money, Myth, and Misinformation in the War on Terror. The chapter on Somalia is also posted on the Counterpunch website. You can go to the Red Eye website for the link, and our website address is www.cooperadio.org/redeye.